Welcome to Phoenix Rising with Dr. Z. This podcast is all about conversations about healing and rising from the ashes of your grief and trauma. In this podcast, we will be deconstructing and highlighting the different aspects of grief and loss. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Zampatella. Well, welcome, everybody. This is Phoenix Rising with Dr. Z. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Zampatella. And today we are going to be touching on a very important topic, but also near and dear to my heart. As if you know, you've been listening to the podcast thus far, you have learned that my brother Damien did die from a drug overdose at the age of 22. And Laura, who is visiting with me today, I'm going to let her introduce herself and everything that she does. But she has graciously offered to be part of the podcast. And so I'm super excited because this is one, it's going to hit a lot of you. And I'm interested in seeing what you guys have to say about what you're learning about this. So welcome, Laura Vargas. Please, I'd like to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself, talk about where you're at, what you do, anything else you think would be good for our viewers and listeners to know.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me, Dr. Z. Excited to be here with you all. My name is Laura Vargas. As she mentioned, by training, I'm a licensed clinical social worker. In my current role, I am the director of outreach programs for peer support community partners. Our focus is on expanding peer-based grief support for deaths due to substance use. In my previous role, I had started a program in the city of Philadelphia through the medical examiner's office called Philly Heals, which was professional grief support for deaths due to substance use. So really looking forward to talking about this topic. I think it's something that has affected probably every single person listening to this at some level with the way that things have gone in our country. So really excited to be here.
And I think you're making a really good point, like whether or not you were directly impacted like I was with my brother Damien. And actually, I've known other people that have died also from drug overdose, whether or not you're working with people or you've known people. You're right. It's everywhere. It's a huge epidemic. And I just want to make it clear to our viewers, we're not going to just be talking about opioid overdose, although that is a huge issue in our culture, as we know. But like you said, I'd like to be able to talk about other things that are happening and some of the complications that maybe other people aren't familiar with. Like, you know, you and I were talking before the podcast about, you know, fentanyl laced, you know, cocaine and deaths that are occurring as a result of that. So we can just go ahead and get started. And what do you feel, what's happening right now? Like, what the hell is going on?
I think that where we're at right now is hugely impacted by the pandemic. So we knew that we had this opioid crisis. We had been starting to pay attention to it. Documentaries were coming out about big pharma and all sorts of things, but people were kind of going through their lives, business as normal. Those who were using opioids knew the risks. Naloxone, otherwise known as Narcan, was getting out, and things were pretty much at bay. But there were people who were recreationally using drugs who never felt like there was a risk. When the pandemic hit, everything changed. All of our resources and services shut down, the borders shut down, which had a huge impact on the drug market. So rather than getting fentanyl, which had been coming in from international, from countries outside of the US, people learned how to make them in the US. And so that's when we saw this flood of fentanyl into all sorts of drugs beyond opioids, and why people who didn't believe that they were at risk or that harm reduction measures needed to take place, why we're seeing all of these deaths now of more recreational users, younger individuals, way older individuals. The demographics have completely shifted of who's dying from this. And it is because of that blood of fentanyl once it started to be made in the country.
I had no idea. I mean, it makes perfect sense. So what I'm hearing you say is before the pandemic, a lot of fentanyl was coming from over the borders. And mm-hmm. then afterwards, because everything kind of closed down and people didn't have the same access, that we started making it and distributing it here in the United States. And then it became accessible to other people. And like you, I had no idea the demographics changed. Are we seeing older people that are now dying from overdose? Are we seeing younger people? Like, how's it changed?
We're seeing way older and way younger. So we're seeing older adults, those in their 60s and 70s, a lot of them individuals who had used crack cocaine for many years, and again, didn't identify with the messaging that we had about opioids. All of a sudden, fentanyl went in there and that changed everything. Likewise, younger individuals in high school who might be testing out just pills that previously would have, you know, been actual pharmaceutical pills, but now we're seeing all that pressed fentanyl. And so we're getting kind of these two ends of the spectrum beyond what we were typically used to seeing of the 20, 30, and 40-year-olds. We're seeing way beyond that on both ends.
How are we going to deal with that as a culture and as a community? Now, we're not out of the pandemic, but obviously, and my last interview was just about all the pandemic stuff and COVID, but considering we're operating in a world as if, you know, COVID is gone, like how do we deal with this?
Yep. Well, I think we can have a whole conversation about harm reduction, but trying to kind of keep it in line with grief. Having people talk about it, knowing that this is happening to everyone. You don't need to hide this. You don't need to carry that stigma. If we talk about it, we'll recognize and people will connect with the messaging that anybody can be at risk. And so really having these open and honest conversations can allow people to fully understand what's happening and that this isn't something that is just happening to individuals who have been battling addiction for many years, but that this is something that is happening to everyone and no family is immune to it. So again, there's a whole conversation we could have about harm reduction, but I would say the first step is openly speaking about it, not feeling any shame, and knowing that this is a countrywide or international, but in this case, we'll focus on the country, a countrywide issue that there's a lot of work to do.
All right. So I'm going to take a couple steps back because I'm hearing what you're saying here. Because I know, well, I don't know, but I'm assuming families don't know how to have conversations about this. Communities do not know how to have conversations about this. There is shame in families. You know, there is an assumption that if there's somebody who's addicted to some kind of substance, and that might be a reflection on the entire family, or a reflection on, you know, who that person was as a human being, as opposed to a person who was struggling with an addiction. And so I've got so many, many things to say about that, but I'm going to back up a second. So tell me, can you tell us a little bit about what is happening other than fentanyl? Tell us first of all, what the hell is fentanyl? Because I don't think a lot of people know. And because we hear, you know, cocaine, crack, heroin, you know, that, you know, alcohol, marijuana, like, but fentanyl is not like, not as known. Does that make sense? Am I making any sense? Am I right? Is that even
you are
right?
Making sense? Okay. You are making sense, because especially now, a lot of people are talking about it without knowing what it is. So fentanyl, it's a synthetic opioid. It had been used, or it still is used, in terminal cancer in hospitals by physicians for really, really complex pain. Somewhere along the line, it got thrown into being a part of street drugs. And so again, we were getting it from outside of the borders. Then we learned how to make it, but it's a very, very potent opioid. It's X amount of times a lot more potent than morphine, than heroin. It's kind of like the top of the level. And it's something that can be produced and distributed in lots of different forms. So people could buy a pill that they might think is a Percocet or a Xanax or Adderall or something. You know, that's where we're seeing a lot of the younger individuals who are buying these pills thinking it's one thing, but it could be pressed fentanyl, and they can make it look exactly how the pill would use, down to the little numbers that you see on a pill. So that's why it's so dangerous. It can also be sold as a powder that people would buy thinking it's any drug that comes in powder form, like cocaine. It can be smoked, it can be injected. So it's really ubiquitous and it's everywhere. And so that is the challenge. And a little bit of fentanyl is very lethal. And so that's why we saw this epidemic and this crisis skyrocket. You know, we started to see the numbers increase steadily in around 2016, 2017, when fentanyl was starting to come in. And then we see this huge boom 2020, 2021, 2022, still seeing it once we started making it in-house. And it's most of these deaths have at least some level of fentanyl, even if the person had no intention or no idea that they were consuming it.
Wow. Okay. So there are plenty of people out there who might be using other types of substances and aren't even aware that they may be taking this, and a little bit really can be very lethal. Why would people want to make fentanyl look like other kinds of drugs?
Much cheaper, much more accessible, and much more addictive. So if the person does stay alive, they're more likely to come back for more. It's not the best business model because, again, you take this huge risk, but it's something that we're seeing. There's also a lot of cross-contamination. So sometimes when they have these crazy news articles that are really, a lot of it is fear-mongering of fentanyl found in marijuana or things like that, that's not the intention. That could just be, you know, whoever's manufacturing it isn't cleaning up too well in between batches. And so, like I said, a tiny bit can go a long way. So usually when we hear it in things that don't make sense, where it has kind of that opposite effect, it's usually just cross-contamination because it's so widely available now and just so much cheaper than everything else.
Who's making this?
Anyone from, you know, your at home drug lab to, you know, it still is getting in. They'll have those big news of the seizures at the border of fentanyl coming, but there's also just that rinky dink garage drug lab.
Breaking Bad, running around in a, yeah, you know what I mean? Isn't that weird though? There's a whole, and I loved that series, you know, without, you know, and I mean, it was all about drugs, and it was almost like sensationalized as a result of it, even though it's terrible, there's still a whole bunch of sensationalization, and there's so much money that is passed along, you know, hand to hand, and you see this lifestyle that some of these drug dealers have, and they have these lifestyles that some people could only dream about. You know, if you're from a low socioeconomic, I'm not even saying this is only for low, you know, people in low socioeconomic status. This hits everybody from low to high socioeconomic status. But when you have people that are coming from a place of having nothing to a place where they're seeing people that are having everything, is that part of the picture? Am I...
It is part of the picture, and it's very correlated with also the increases that we're seeing in gun violence. You know, a lot of those are connected in terms of the gun violence with the drug crisis. So it's causing a lot of damage in our communities, not just deaths from overdose or from drug intoxication, but also from the gun violence that comes with such fast, heavy lifestyles.
So wait. So let me see if I got this right. As a result of the drug use being accelerated, we're seeing an acceleration of gun violence as well.
In certain communities.
Correlation between the two.
In certain communities, yes. In Philadelphia, that is something that we're seeing a lot of in terms of like rival drug gangs, if you will, or, you know, it's there's when there's so much money at hand and so much money available, people will do all sorts of things.
Is there anything that we're doing in our educational system that is like informing? The first thing I'm thinking of is the fact that I've got three stepsons, right? All of which I imagine they are learning about, you know, I'm sure they're learning about it in school, but probably not nearly as much as they need to. But, you know, they're being exposed to, you know, drugs in general. Like if they're taking them, I'm going to kill them. They should know that now. You'll see me on the news. There's no way. I'm exaggerating. I'd be very, very worried, you know, of course. But are we doing enough for our children and adolescents to open up even a line of communication, since it seems to be trickling down to even younger people?
Yeah. It's a push and pull. Some communities are very progressive with harm reduction, which is really where we need to be going with this. We know from the just say no era that that didn't work. Just telling people not to do drugs, it's not going to work. It's a matter of using harm reduction. And fortunately, we have a lot of tools available. Again, we would prefer for our loved ones to not even mess with it, not even try it out. But recognizing that some people just aren't going to listen to that no, what can we do? How can we educate people about the risks? How can we educate people about mitigating the risks? And a lot of communities will include that in middle school and high school information on how to get naloxone, Narcan, which is the opioid reversal medication, how to get fentanyl test strips, which is something that's now available. Other communities, not so much. In some areas, these things are still illegal. They're considered drug paraphernalia, and let's just not talk about it. Let's not use them. And we're seeing, you know, a lot of concern there of people not even knowing that they're at risk. Again, if they think that they're purchasing something that has nothing to do with opioids, they don't even know to have these things available, like the fentanyl test strips, like the Narcan. But for those who are more comfortable having these open conversations, recognizing that knowledge is power, that it's so much more effective than just telling people not to do something, then we can start to, you know, have these really honest conversations that could have much more positive impacts.
And then there are two things that popped in my mind. First of all, the fact that Narcan and fentanyl test strips are considered drug paraphernalia in any place is a dumb ass thing. I can't even right now. I cannot even. Because there have been times where I've wondered if Damien, you know, if he was around somebody that would have had the Narcan, you know, or whatever, like, would it have, you know, stopped? Now, that's an if only, and I play around with that in my mind, but it does make me wonder. But are you freaking kidding me? Like, this is, okay, anyway, so.
We see the numbers.
Unreal.
Pointing that out. We see that most deaths generally are occurring in the home, and it's because people are alone and there's nobody there. We're not seeing as many deaths on the street, you know, where you might have a lot of people using drugs together because somebody has Narcan and someone can Narcan the other person. And so a lot of what we're seeing with, you know, with Philadelphia, those are the numbers I'm most familiar with, 70% of deaths due to substance use occur in the home.
Wow. Okay, so the reasoning behind it is this is just going to encourage people to, you know, go ahead and use because they can be saved from, you know, an overdose. And since, you know, this is in the community of people that are using, then it gives them a little bit more, less fear about overdosing. So
people will make that argument. But at the end of the day, it's a matter of safety in numbers. You know, that's another harm reduction thing. If you are going to use a drug, use with somebody else, use at different, you know, stagger your time so that you can look out for one another. Don't do it alone. But, you know, when these things are illegal, when Narcan is legal, when test strips are illegal, when there's so much shame involved, people who have the privilege of having a home can do it in private to not, you know, be seen, not be judged, not have their families be judged, but then there's nobody there to try to resuscitate them, try to save them.
That is really scary. And I think you're making a really good point that I think some of our listeners and viewers are going to like lose their shit over, which is the whole, well, if you're going to do it this way. And they're like, what are you talking about? You're encouraging people to find more, you know, not healthier ways, but safer ways to use drugs. And it's like, the reality is that people are doing it. And like you said, you know, the just say no. When I was, I was in my early 20s. I had this job as a teaching assistant in this school that was very super duper small. And it was for, it was in a low socioeconomic status neighborhood up in Westchester. And they came with this board, right? And I had a whole bunch of different pills on it. And they were talking about how all, and it had just say no on the top. And so they had the entire little school sitting in front with their little, just say no board in front of them. And I'm thinking to myself, this isn't going to do shit. Nobody's going to stop doing anything because of this. All you're doing is showing them what it looks like. I guarantee you at least half of those kids had already seen those things in their houses and probably already know what they do. Like, seriously, young, difficult, these lower socioeconomic status neighborhoods where it's just flooded, you know, it's flooded everywhere, but it's just so blatantly flooded. So I'm agreeing with you, but I know some people are going to be like, what the but you're right. I mean, the reality is it's not, we're not going to look at somebody and go, you just got to stop. And it reminds me of when we have a kid, I don't know who I was talking to about this the other day, but like, let's say you have a kid and the kid hits because he's angry and he doesn't have any other coping skills. You cannot look at this kid and go, you stop hitting people, and not teach him what else to do. Because guess what's happening? He's going to white knuckle it until he can't handle it anymore. There's no other coping skills, and he's going to go right back to hitting because nobody tried to help him have, you know, coping skills in a different way. So you can say, don't do it all you want. If there's nothing that's following up with that, you know, then, and I don't think that's going to make anything better. But all right. So anyway, I got off track because I like to take the scenic route everywhere. The question here then is, it's about communication, about opening up communication, taking away the shame. Who's supposed to provide that? Who's in
charge?
You know?
Every level of the community, from your home, your family, your friends, from anywhere where you're getting your information. I think just making sure that the streets are flooded with information about what's happening, but also what we can do, because a lot of it is just alarming. You know, this is terrible, but then there's no clear steps. You know, it kind of goes back to that just I know of all these numbers. You know, we're getting over 100,000 deaths each year in just the U.S. due to substance use. Over 100,000. And the news loves to show that number, freak everyone out. But then it's a matter of, well, how do you get help if you're struggling, or if you're not struggling, but you can just be more educated and know kind of what's out there, how to help somebody else, how to recognize if someone you know is struggling. And so always having the information, yes, it's important to get the facts out there, important to get the numbers to make sure people understand the magnitude of this. Also, what can we do? And sometimes it involves thinking outside of the box, pushing a little bit past our morals and recognizing that a lot of this has been deeply, deeply researched by science, and knowing that harm reduction, education, talking about it is more powerful than just trying to avoid it, trying to act like it's not happening, or trying to just wish it away.
When you say harm reduction, and I know you said earlier, we could have an entire podcast on that. And if you'd like, yes, let's go ahead and do that. That's fine. But what is that?
Harm reduction, it doesn't have to apply just to substance use, but it's most frequently used with substance use. It's meeting somebody where they're at, trying to reduce the harms that are happening, not trying to impose abuse. So the perfect example here would be null test strips, giving those out. So on the one hand, you could just tell people, don't use drugs, and that's it. I don't want to be a part of it. I don't want to see what you're doing. I don't agree with this. That's one way to go about it. Somebody might still do that. The other way would be meet them where they're at. And this is much harder when it's a loved one. I'm talking from like a public health perspective, like community-wide approach. It's much more nuanced when it's your loved one and all the emotions are at stake. But from a public health perspective, it's a matter of, we know this is happening. How can we try to keep people alive? Because if we keep them alive, there's hope that they will stay alive. If they're struggling with substance use, there's hope that this one time they will go into recovery and maintain their recovery. If somebody is dead, there's no hope. You know, if we're not trying to keep people alive with everything that we have available to us. And so harm reduction is, how do we use these tools that we have to reduce harms, to try to keep people as safe as possible, to not judge them, not stigmatize them, and just try to be there for them. People are much more likely to seek support, to open up, to make plans, to move forward when they have that non-judgmental presence. Mm-hmm.
So a lot of this is more on a macro level. It's macro and micro level, like the community level, but also talking about the micro levels of like being able to educate, you know, family members and friends. And then that's a whole nother ball game, because you've got a lot of dynamics that are associated with the, like you said, the morals and value systems that are there. And a lot of times tell me if I'm wrong, but a lot of times what leads people to drug use are problems along abuse and attachment. And it, this just, it doesn't usually just show up like, you know, all of a sudden at 35 years old, the person's like, no, screw it. I'm just going to start using drugs. There's usually something that is from, I mean, at least I'm saying this as a psychologist, and I'm sure you as a social worker, working with people who have been in abusive backgrounds, whose childhood was not stable, who are coming from places of insecurity and not even sometimes not even knowing who's in your corner. So having families educated about it, when the families might not give a shit in the first place because they've got their own intergenerational trauma being passed down, like who are they left to? So there's the community, right? Schools and, you know, boys and girls clubs and who else? Who else can be educated about this? I guess, what, churches, synagogues, and so forth? Who else?
That's a big push that has actually been happening. Public health trying to work with religious leaders, with faith leaders, because they have such an impact on the community. It's really asking this question that you're asking of who has the most impact, whether it be celebrities, whether it be places of worship, whether it be physicians. You know, there's a lot of push towards screening, just how we implemented the depression screening that you now do, you know, every time you go to see your PCP, those two questions, and then they'll talk to you about it. There's the same thing. There's this push for screening for substance use, because if we're not talking about it, we don't know what's going on. Someone could very well be struggling with this and could be functioning just fine on the outside and could be deeply at risk. So any opportunity to connect with someone is an opportunity to intervene, to educate, to provide information and resources.
Doctors aren't screening for this on a regular basis. Like, this isn't like a question of how can not? I don't understand.
They should be. It's not like a clear protocol yet. Some are, you know, some will talk to you about this. There's those questions you get. How many drinks do you have a week? How many cigarettes do you smoke a week? You know, these questions that they ask, but we haven't gone beyond to really specify it so that people can understand. I can answer this question even if I don't think I have a problem, you know, making it really conversational and not just this checklist that you're going through. In the ER, it barely comes up, and people could be there for any number of reasons that if it's not a clear overdose, they might not talk about it. If it's a clear overdose, you know, people will, some hospitals do have peer recovery specialists and those who will keep people to rehabs, but somebody could very well go to the ER for something, and that's a missed opportunity to provide that information to them. So we need to stop thinking that it's just people who have very clear, long-standing addictions or people that are just had an overdose, but this could be anyone. Let's make sure that everyone is talking about it so that we're not letting anyone slip through the cracks.
It's interesting as you're mentioning this, because as a psychologist and other mental health professionals, this is part of our intake. And if you're not doing this as part of your intake, you better damn well get, you know, on it, because we're not all forced to become drug and alcohol counselors, right? Like, I mean, if I have somebody, I know for a fact that I am not trained in drug and alcohol counseling, but so many people that come to my office with trauma and guilt and grief and sadness and whatever, like attachment related issues, whatever. But certainly a lot of in trauma, I have to refer them out when I find that there's drug and alcohol use, because I know that I can't treat that. Right. And until they get, you know, at least sobriety and some coping skills and get some, you know, get themselves stable enough, then they can come to me and then I can do the work. Because if I open up the work, especially with the trauma and the grief and depression and all that, that can just lead them to relapse, and it could lead them to, you know, additional more problematic use. But I don't even think mental health professionals take that very seriously, because when you come in to come see me, then I am not, sometimes people don't disclose it, even though you've asked directly. Yeah. And you're like, you've got this good therapeutic relationship and you've been working with somebody for 3 months. And then all of a sudden, you know, they let something slip, you know, that they have been using the whole time, or they just started using, and you're like, ugh. Because I've had clients started using as a result of perhaps looking into all of the trauma and the grief. So you're like, shit, I've got to, you know, now I need to get more training. It's my responsibility to get more training in drug and alcohol counseling, but I don't want to be a drug and alcohol counselor. That's a whole different ball game for, you know, people. And it's like how many, I only have so many hours in the day, but I do have that responsibility as a mental health professional. So that becomes really problematic as well.
Right. Right. It goes into Maslow's hierarchy, you know, meeting the most immediate needs first. And so if somebody is struggling with substance use, you want to make sure that that is handled because that is deadlier in the moment than, you know, the anxiety that they're working through. Let's get that figured out, or at least get them as safe as possible, and then work through all of these very difficult things that are going to raise emotions. And that's the only coping skill. We need to figure out some other ones.
You know, I also think that I do not think, at least in our area, I do not feel like there is a centralized enough location for people in mental and physical health to get together and say, oh, these are all the people that are doing this kind of work. Here's the psychiatrists that are doing this kind of work. Like, what are the resources in the community, you know, who provide methadone and stuff like that? I feel like there's a lack of connection between medical and mental health when it comes to substance abuse. Did you notice that in Philadelphia too?
Philadelphia's worked really hard towards this because that was an issue. And if we all work together, we could do so much more. So something, and I was based out of the health department. And so we were bringing together different providers and different stakeholders, if you will, to come together and discuss these things. That being said, not everybody was at the table. These were like 40, 60 people meetings, but there was a push recognizing that this multidisciplinary approach is crucial. You know, you can have the doctor that's giving the medication assisted treatment, and, you know, people are handled physically, but you know, you also want to have the therapist that can help with the emotions and the social worker that can help them find a job again, or, you know, whatever is happening, you do want this team, but unfortunately it has not been the standard. And if only we could get there, you know, communities that have worked towards this, and it's usually smaller communities because it's more manageable than large cities where there's 20 nonprofits for every social problem. But if we can get everyone together and get people connected, it would just have so many like ripple effects there in terms of getting people as stable and healthy as possible.
So really trying to take an interdisciplinary wraparound approach to people. So here's another fun fact. Health insurance. Lack thereof, awareness of where to go. You know, Medicaid services are here. They might be shitty over here. There might be resources over here. You don't qualify for Medicaid because you're in a different socioeconomic status, so you can't get that here. But, you know, your insurance, you know, there's no clinicians in the area that don't have a wait list. And I mean, I'm thinking of every problem out there, and maybe that's pretty like jaded, but I'm seeing people who, you know, clinicians who are going off of health insurances because they're not getting paid for the work that they're doing in a way that allows them to keep their doors open or to feed their family. And I think there's a lot of misnomers about, well, you're a doctor, you're making a ton of money. Let me tell you something. With the health insurances, and if I'm trying to keep the doors open, it's not as much as one might think. So then you're running into practitioners who are wanting to provide help, but are in a system that makes it fail.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
This the sucks. Insurance.
It does. And I have a lot of clients from my work in Philadelphia whose loved one had died from substance use, and a lot of people that could directly tie it to the issues with insurance kicking people out of treatment too long. 30 days isn't enough to work through a 10-year addiction. You know, we need longer services. We need those that connect them to all the different services that they need. But when we're relying on a system that is just for profit, trying to minimize the costs, trying to, you know, send people out, not care for them as long as needed, we end up with a lot of deaths and we end up with a lot of pain and hardship. So that could be a whole nother episode, the issues with insurance.
We're going to have like 90 different episodes on insurance. And who is the government giving us enough money to take care of this?
There's a lot of funding. And the big topic right now is the opioid settlement funds from the pharmaceutical companies. So there is a lot of money coming in. It's just bureaucracy in terms of people wanting and communities wanting to figure out the best way to spend this money. So a lot of it will be town halls and community advisory groups, which are all great and important to make sure that these funds are spent in a way that's community informed, but it just adds on some more time. So they're trickling into communities. We'll be seeing a lot more services hopefully roll out throughout the next year, 2-3 years, because there's tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, just from the settlement funds on top of what the government was already investing in this. So there's a lot of money there. But it'll be, you know, slow to see how positive an impact that has in terms of decreasing deaths and whatnot.
Who's in charge of getting that money out into our community?
So there was a big thing in Pennsylvania where Philadelphia wanted to kind of do it on their own, but then the state did it. So it's a lot of like state attorney general's offices, or if it's more local, it'll be like a district attorney's office. It's different. You know, it's just how kind of like the different governments operate. But again, it's best if it is community informed, even if it takes a little bit longer, but the community can say, no, you know, we've already spent millions of dollars on these 1-800 commercials on what to do if you need help. Let's spend this money on XYZ, on more harm reduction, on grief support is a big one. You know, that's one that I'm always pushing for and telling people to push for. You know, there's all this funding out there. Let's try to have it go towards the people whose lives have already been destroyed by this crisis. There's a lot of funding for prevention and harm reduction, and we should never decrease that, because the first thing we want to do is keep people alive. But let's also not forget the people who already lost their loved one, who are struggling, and no one's looking at them traditionally when they're making these policies.
Thank you for listening to Phoenix Rising with Dr. Z. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it, subscribe, and leave a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. We want to be a resource for anyone who is experiencing loss, and this is a simple way you can help us spread the word. Check out our show description. There you'll find a link to connect with me on social media, as well as helpful articles and resources.